Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine Podcast Radio. You're about to listen to an episode of Tech Done Different Podcast with Ted Harrington. Do you follow the pack or challenge the status quo? Join Ted as he explores how to succeed by going against conventional wisdom. You'll hear leaders in technology and security tell stories about how they achieve their success by doing things differently. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Tech Done Different. As always, I'm your host, Ted Harrington. And with me here today is a special guest, someone that I've long admired with what he's doing in his realm, and he's going to come share with us some ideas from outside of technology. Elliot El-Khoury, the founder of Ace Properties. Elliot, thank you so much for being on the show.
Ted, thank you. I'm so excited to be on this. This is actually my first official podcast. I've been kind of putting these off for so long, but they're great. And having these kind of conversations with people outside of my usual space, I'm pumped to do it.
Hell yeah. Well, mark the calendars. Today was the first podcast, and remember us when you're famous. So actually, you already are famous, to be honest.
just on TikTok, right? Just with a bunch of like 22-year-olds.
There's so much about that one statement that we definitely want to dig into to today. And we'll start there. But first, I wanted to just give our audience a little bit of context about like who you are and why I wanted you to be on this show, because they might be thinking, wait, this guy's in real estate? What's the application here? And as I like to do in this show, the whole purpose of the show is to help people think differently. And so I like to bring in voices from outside tech to say, well, here's how I do things, or here's how I think differently, so that hopefully those of us in tech can think differently. And your thoughts and ideas, I definitely respect and admire. So hopefully we can extract some of the wisdom. But let's start with TikTok, because this is so hilarious to me that you are a real estate investor, you serve real estate investors, and yet you have this massive following on TikTok. You found this opportunity to really evangelize your message in a really unexpected place. So can you walk us through sort of your thought process for how did you identify that as an opportunity, and how did you know that that was something to go big on?
Well, like most process innovations, it was an accident, right? It was a complete accident. I think we started using Instagram to try to get investors to follow us a little bit more, because we realized a lot of investors a lot of investment providers or companies that are in the real estate space don't really use social media much. So we saw it as like an opening, and we just couldn't get that reach on Instagram that we wanted. So we're like, all right, let's do videos. And man, recording videos and editing videos is a bunch of work. And we've got a full-time business to run here. We're not full-time social media influencers. That's not where we generate our revenue. So how can we make this quick? And I had a friend who's big on social media, and he kind of consulted with us at first. He said, make your videos on TikTok. Make videos only for Instagram and make them on TikTok, because it's just a really easy platform. And while you're there, just post them on TikTok, right? And I remember this was like in the beginning of 2020, like January 2020, February 2020. So right before the pandemic hit and TikTok blew up. So there was a timing and luck component of being early to that market, because I remember posting daily, and it was like 5,000 views, 5,000 views, 5,000 views. And I made some silly video about like, this is my house, and oh, I don't pay for it. Just some catchy tagline. And then boom, like 350,000 views, like over a weekend. And I'm like, I didn't pay a dollar of advertising. 350,000 people just watched what I had to say there over about 15 or 20 minutes of work. Like, this is massive. So I kind of stuck with it, and it didn't blow up quite that fast, but it was so unsaturated. It was like, and this is, I guess, a theme of your podcast often, probably, this space was so uncompetitive and uncrowded. And I remember like my friends, like younger brothers and younger sisters are like, why are you on my TikTok feed? Like, get off my TikTok. I'm trying to do a dance video and like lip sync. And even my employees, like I had a younger employee at the time who was like 23, and she kind of ridiculed me. And she was like, hey, your investors that are coming in and opting in, like, they're a complete waste of time, the people that are coming from TikTok, but stayed the course just because of the amount of reach. And I figured like any platform where you could be in front of hundreds of thousands of people easily with little effort and money, like, that's worth investing in.
Yeah. And you combine that certainly with you're good at it. I mean, the you're able to distill these ideas down into these short little videos. And you know, I watch like pretty much everything that you post, and every single one, I'm like, oh yeah. In like 5 seconds, I just got a really good idea. So how do you do that? How do you distill an idea down so simply?
You know, it's all about stories for me. Stories and value. Like when it comes to getting on social media and being in front of people, and I think the future of like advertising is social media. I think social media is like the new TV. And I think the internet is like really in like the early stages of its maturity. And people are just interacting with, everything comes through these social platforms. Like there's one for everything now. And every business that's trying to evolve into being an internet business includes some level of like community and ecosystem, right? So people are just in their smartphones. And smartphones are excellent devices now. They're far better than they used to be. You could do everything through them. So reaching this broad audience, but also giving them a ton of value. Because you look at the competitors out there and they're all trying to kind of sell something. And I think in a lot of spaces, it's very obvious what a business wants. Instead, I try to focus, and it falls flat on its face often, but you got to try. Try to focus on what the people who are watching the video want, and then just give them something that I probably should be charging them for in that video, but for free every time.
Oh, that's really good advice, right? Yeah, it seems intuitive. Start with what people want. But you're totally right. I mean, even within a lot of social media, advertising, you see a lot of stuff that's like, this is just one way blasting of a message as opposed to teaching people things. And yeah, that idea of give them the thing that you should charge for. And it seems like, I don't want to speak for your business, so tell me if I'm right or wrong on this, but it seems like by giving those ideas away that you should charge for, it pays for itself multiple fold when people say, well, I want more of this guy because it's so good.
Every time, like customers come to us with a parasocial relationship. Like I get on a Zoom call with a client that wants to spend $1 million with us, and they know you already. It isn't a cold call. Nothing's cold anymore. And it's infinitely scalable too, because what you could do is take this like archaic system of following up with clients and engagement, and you can like democratize it into spending 30 minutes a day on creating one piece of content every day that's useful. And showing your personality and the culture of your business, if your brand goes beyond you and your business has its own brand, but showing the personality and vision and mission of your brand to all of your customers and your whole sphere of influence every single day, it completes the sale. Yeah. So it's very scalable, especially for a small business where you don't have like a TV advertising budget, right? Or just tons of money for Google AdWords that isn't as easy to be able to get into and have that kind of reach.
It's interesting, this idea of giving away for free the things you should charge for, because I'm actually struggling with this right now in that one of the things that we do in our security consulting business is we're always saying to people like, hey, are you struggling with something? I'll put you on a call with one of our consultants and you just talk it through with them. And we don't charge for it. We absorb all the costs for that. And it's literally that. It's literally like free consulting. And We often run into resistance where people are like, what's the catch? What are you really doing here? I'm like, I'm just trying to give you free advice, because I believe what you've demonstrated to be true, that if I give it away for free and it helps somebody and it's the right fit on both sides, then like future good things will come from it. I don't need to charge you for that first conversation in order to deliver value or to obtain value later.
And I like to tell my clients that flat out. Like they'll come to me and go like, what's in it for you? And I'm like, let me tell you, like when I give you all this free stuff, you're going to buy stuff from me and I'm going to make a ton of money and you're going to be happy. And when you put that out there, it's almost like that thing that like they think you like were doing secretly, but since it's not a secret anymore and your motivations are very clear, and it almost seems genuine, and genuine means relationship.
Oh, that's so good. The theme of relationships is one that surprisingly comes up a lot on the show. And I say, I don't know, maybe the audience is not as surprised as I am. But, you know, I think about technology, right? It's so scientific and so technical, but relationships are the heart of it. And it sounds like that's what you're saying in your business too, right?
Oh my goodness. And in technology, I think like people have accepted that there's some level of like automation and kind of computers and software doing things for you. And I'm not a techie, so I can't really speak for it, right? But in real estate, relationships are everything. It always kind of has been that way. It's very like good old boy, spit on your hand and shake somebody else's and you've got a deal. And there's still like artifacts of that in this business, not even artifacts. Like that's still kind of the foundation or the central dogma of this business. So I imagine technology, like people in the technology space often take advantage of the fact that relationships are maybe underutilized or underemphasized because it's easy to move on without them, or the infrastructure of a business allows you to not need it. In real estate, the technology is not present and the relationship's everything. So it's kind of like the converse. It's how can I use technology to amplify the ability to build relationships here? Because it is already a relationship contingent business.
I think that piece of advice isn't just real estate. I mean, that sounds like every business, right? How do we use technology to amplify relationships rather than replace them? And I remember a conversation that happened a few years ago in our business where we were talking about some like an automated workflow that we were trying to set up. And I remember vividly, we're sitting in this conference room and with the teams that were all involved who are going to like benefit from this. And I remember one person raised their hand and basically said, well, this will be great because then I no longer have to now talk to those people on the other team. And I'm like, all right, hold on. We are going down the wrong path if that's what we're thinking, right?
And like the idea of being able to talk to a bunch of people without actually having to talk to them, like the concept of using the technology is how can I talk to more people at once in a shorter period of time, but still give them what they need?
Yeah,
that's our implementation of it. That's the whole point of it is how can I use this piece of me and our business and our employees here use this piece of them that makes the deal happen, that brings the money to the table, but then offer that piece to so many more people than you normally could by means of traditional handshake or a 30-minute scheduled call or whatever it is.
Yeah. I hear you, man. One of the things that surprised me about even this podcast itself was that when, you know, pandemic happened and everything, you know, you just couldn't interact with people in the same way anymore. And we're sort of figuring out like, how do we do this by video? And then it was like, well, how do you continue to like hang out with people and build relationships and network and just like expand the people that you know? And it's like the best thing that I've seen is like virtual happy hours and stuff. And those are okay. They're fine. This podcast has been such an amazing way for me to be able to go have those conversations with smart people and get ideas and like literally ask for advice. Like that's a lot of what the show is. I'm like, I have this problem. Can you help me with
this? I don't know if I can solve your problems for you, right? But it's a lot of fun. It's like almost like a vehicle of socialization too. And I remember like before the pandemic, I would have never gotten on a Zoom whiskey date with like one of my guy friends. I would have never. But like now it's something you look forward to.
Totally. Well, I want to go open some whiskey right now on this podcast.
Can I show this on this podcast? It's within arm's reach all the time.
Mine? Oh man, I don't have one in arm's reach. I should have prepared accordingly. But
it's probably a good thing that you have to walk to get yours.
Well, you know, I'm changing it after this, so it won't happen again that way. So let me switch gears a little bit and ask you about evaluating markets, because one of the things that really I find really interesting about the insights that you are teaching in the various social media platforms that you're sharing them are these ideas around like, if everyone's going after a certain market, here's how you might think about that market and do something differently. So you talk about this example, how, you know, everyone's really excited about say investing in Chicago for rental properties. And you say, well, how about this property that's like an hour or this neighborhood that's an hour outside of Chicago. So can you extract the principles from that philosophy and talk about how to evaluate markets and evaluate opportunities?
Investing 101 is about being a contrarian. Like the investors that really win and beat the market, they find that alpha, like the stock market folks love to say that, right? But in real estate or any asset class, even in investing in a business or operating a business, I think it's about beating the market by performing some sort of alternative investment methodology or business methodology. Finding something that's wrongfully undervalued. And wrongfully is the asterisk, right? So what you got to do is you got to look at everything that everyone doesn't like. And then you've got to go look for reasons that they're wrong about that. And you can find those reasons almost like first it was luck for us, right? And then it was filtration. It was, let's look at a bunch of markets people don't like and see what meets our criteria. Then we actually were able to start to find certain methodologies to determine where undervaluation exists and why, and the reasons people use the wrong screening principles to cross off a market when they're looking for their next apartment building or something like that. A lot of it is in the history of an investment. And you see it in the stock market too. This hasn't returned this much for this many years. But that kind of like shows a fundamental misunderstanding of like all the intangibles of what's going on with that actual business. And it's the same with that market. Now, the beautiful thing about real estate is that it is a people business. And I already kind of touched on that earlier, like in like back office, right? It's about handshakes and relationships and such. It's a very people-driven business in the operation side of things too, and in actually understanding these markets. But no one has time for that. So people just look at like analytics, and oftentimes on like Google or like Census Bureau, and the methodology behind the statistics don't tell the story of what a real estate market's really doing, or maybe don't represent the particular asset or every different asset class in that market. Maybe there's a lot of variance where the broader is not doing well. So you have like, let's say the greater Chicago market and that Midwestern market is kind of on the slow decline, but it's this big space moving down really slowly. And while it's moving down slowly, there's a bunch of stuff doing this within it, right? Or a bunch of stuff doing this within it. And you want to find the one that's doing that. That's real estate in kind of a bottle. And I think the solution is finding ways to understand why other people make quick assumptions incorrectly.
Wow. That's that in of itself is like its own podcast topic. So how do we do that? I totally hear what you're saying, right? That, cause I see it all the time, and maybe this is just like me as a person, but I'll see like the type of question that someone else is asking. And I was actually having a conversation like this just this morning before you and I started getting together here today with one of the people in our company, where I was saying, you know, that question that person's asking, because this the situation was this. Someone was asking a question outside our company, and then the person in our company who was to go respond to that was like, well, we're not an expert in what this person's asking. And my feedback to him was, well, that guy's asking the wrong question. And instinctively, I knew that just from years of experience. But as I realized, like, how do I explain this to someone else that he's asking the wrong question? And it's along the lines of what you're saying, which is we have to think about and understand the flaws in someone else's reasoning. How do you do that?
It's very interesting. And I know it within the scope of my space, right? So I'm going to try to take it and like maybe generalize the philosophy and not make it so subject matter specific. But it's very often that like someone will come to you with a misunderstanding, like you said. And if you're an expert, if you're the person that's gone and done the work to understand these finer details about this subject that most people just won't unless they're an expert and like are interested in being one or desire to be one, then they're just not going to have those details. So you'll be able to tell them why they were wrong. And I think there's a level above that of like recognition that creates opportunity and is finding out why people have a wrongful assumption about this thing that you truly understand. And then understanding how they got to that wrongful assumption will then give you a kind of a filter of, okay, now I know where the path everyone's going down to get to this wrongful assumption. So I can almost chase opportunities that exist somewhere on that path. Because you can assume that many people will have that wrongful assumption. So it's kind of like a, how did they get there? And for me, it might be something like people coming to me going, well, I don't really love investing in the city of East Chicago, Indiana, because there's been a population decline over the last decade. But they don't know, because it takes a fine understanding of the intangibles, that there was a lead contamination crisis in a subsection of that city in the 2000s that caused a whole section of that city to be uninhabitable and just basically demolished, right? And that forced people to leave because the number of available housing units reduced. Then there were areas nearby it that also experienced some level of contamination that the EPA agreed to remedy, but it happened to coincide with the worst real estate crash of our generation. So landlords left their properties because their values were so low from perception that it wasn't worth investing in keeping these things afloat in this neighborhood that was stigmatized. And so people left because of the lack of availability of housing units. So the population declined, but really what was happening is the demand for quality rentals in the remainder of the city increased dramatically. And rent growth went up dramatically. And as jobs continued to kind of fill in, the housing units were fixed. The supply was fixed and the demand was increasing. So you could still go on Google, type in East Chicago, Indiana, and see that people will go, the population is projected to decline 4% over the last decade. But that's for a systematic reason that people haven't identified.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's pretty powerful, right? Peeling back the curtain to understand what is leading to the sort of almost herd thinking. So you bring up an interesting topic that I would definitely wanted to ask you about, which is numbers. And I think that in such a technical and quantitative field as technology, we obviously, and I think this isn't exclusive to technology, but we're very data driven in this field. And I think a lot of people often look at numbers and say, well, the numbers don't lie. I mean, how often have we heard that phrase? Yet I've seen you in some of the ways that you've talked about different ways of thinking about numbers say, well, the number does say that, but here's why you shouldn't think of it that way. So how do you, what's your take on numbers and how firm and universal they are in terms of the story they tell?
They're not. Numbers lie. Man makes numbers, right? Or man makes the algorithm or the big data that determines what the numbers are. And unless you understand exactly what the methodology and the whole process that leads to that resulting metric is, you don't really understand the truth of the number, the validity of the number. Now, of course, we have to assume sometimes if you really want to dive into a space, you should know the methodology. And this isn't coming from a real estate guy. I was a biotech guy. I worked in big biotech supply chain quality assurance, hundreds of thousands of data points a day doing DNA tests. And what you'd see is people would interpret data incorrectly or generate the data incorrectly or have the wrong methodology for gathering the data and just spit out this result. And for a variety of reasons, the result may not actually tell the story of what's happening. Numbers lie all the time because we influence how the numbers are made.
So do you think there's an extent of maybe confirmation bias in there where we say we expect the data to tell us this and then we want it to tell us that?
There's definitely some confirmation bias. And I think it depends on like person to person too. Like in an organization, there's so much happening like politically and kind of like even on like a human basis, right? That drives everyone's biases, why they want something to look a certain way. I've seen it be as simple as they want their job to be easier or the project timeline to be met or this milestone to be completed, or they want a certain result because that's what the funding is pushing for, or their manager just wants to be able to tell someone up above them that they're done with this thing and they got the success. And numbers are altered for a variety of reasons. It's kind of funny if you go back to like this real estate space, right? People look at population and I go, hey, where do you think those population metrics came from? And then they get the gears get turning, right? And they'll go, no, maybe the census. And I go, okay, how do they measure that? Well, someone came and knocked on my door a couple months ago. What did they ask you? Who lives here and who else lives here? And what are their genders? And not their names, not anything, not how long have they lived here? Not is this their mailing address? And a lot of people don't answer the door. But hey, do you think everyone answers the door? So when you really like look further, I think there's more than confirmation bias. I think there's coming from science, and I don't mean this to sound like a cynic, but people come up with crappy methodology all the time.
Yeah. Well, I was telling this story to my business partner the other day that in college, I was taking a psych class and it was all about statistics and I wanted to study, like there's this seal at, I went to Georgetown and there's a Georgetown seal that like nobody walks on. It's like bad luck. And I wanted to, instead of what I should have measured, which would have gotten me an A, was just how many people step on it versus how many people don't. Uh-huh. But instead, I wanted to measure who gets pissed off if I tell them they did the opposite. So like I stood in front of it with a clipboard and every person who intentionally avoided it, I said, you stepped on the seal. Why did you do that? And then I measured, did they react aggressively? And my, that was pretty junk methodology. My teacher was certainly like, this is a statistics class. You're measuring, like, you think this person is angry. So that was like that's an example of bad methodology trying to actually ascertain an interesting outcome.
Oh, and people like will create like, you know, how project management works. It all starts with a scope of work, right? Yeah. And everyone wants to meet that scope. So they'll go ahead and like force things into conforming with that scope that ends you at that place that you expect. It always happens.
Yeah. So if you think about, I heard you say the other day that you really like taking strategies from tech and sort of applying them to your business, looking at some of the big tech companies and how they've succeeded or failed. What are some of those strategies that you personally like and have applied outside of technology?
Sales process was a big one. sales process was a big one because real estate's like that archaic old sales process. Door knock, leads, shake hands, relationship, cold call, that kind of stuff. And I worked in software sales for a while before I started this, between biotech and this, just to make a little bit more money, right? And the sales process was 100% virtualized and it was volume driven. And the marketing did all the qualification for you and the system qualified leads. And that allowed you to push massive amount of leads into a space where just experts can kind of close up pre-teed up things. So taking something that usually requires a lot of manual screening and then making it a marketing game and pushing it all into a Salesforce account, managing it like that, that was something that I got from software companies. And it opens up a lot of markets too, because when you remove the requirement of proximity and relationship from the lead generation side of things, then all of a sudden your target audience is infinitely large. And that's the same with investors too, is chasing an infinitely large target audience without actually having to do these manual sales tasks, allows you to not only chase more clients, but it also allows you to not have to ever meet with your clients. And I'll tell you this, like a 30-minute Zoom call is always shorter and you'll convert equally, I've noticed, if you set the right expectations versus like a face-to-face meeting. Like investors come to the office here and it's like a 2-3 hour thing and they don't convert it at a higher rate at all, right? I mean, the qualification is a qualification. Took a lot of Lean and Six Sigma principles from biotech supply chain too. A lot of them, and running a business more efficiently, you find that people don't pay attention to that stuff. It's not just really the concept of taking from tech, but it's taking from like bigger businesses and applying big business concepts to a small business. Small businesses operate in this very scrappy way, and that's important. But taking like these economies of scale and like forcing them into a small business, when you build the infrastructure so that these economies of scale exist, scalability is almost like a natural thing to do and not an uphill push.
I love it. So you've said in the past that you are a businessman even more than a real estate investor. So can you tell us a little bit about that and how you sort of perceive the difference between those two?
You know, it sounds a little self-indulgent, right? So, I mean, that's not what it was intended to be, but I enjoy building a business way more than I enjoy investing in real estate. And I think that's because it requires a lot of curiosity and ingenuity. And you could provide a whole lot more value to a lot more people when you take this thing that was just real estate within the confines of your portfolio and you say, okay, this is what I wanted as an investor. Now let's find everyone else that wanted that. I believe that business really teaches you about investments. It's not the other way around, where investments teach you about business. You talked about how do you identify like this inherently undervalued opportunity. And I think business is a better exercise of doing that than investment is. And learning about alternatives, this whole podcast is about thinking differently. I think we're in a world of alternatives where like true invention doesn't really happen anymore. Like I'm not going to come up with like some AI infrastructure that like allows us to democratize real estate investment, but I can go ahead and use tools from different industries to apply it to this and come up with process innovation. So that is where I really, really love business. It is seeking out alternative ways to do things and finding that uncrowded space. Like that's like a hit for me, is finding that next uncrowded space and operating without competition and blowing something open and then offering something to an audience that never had that before. Like, I love that feeling of like, oh, you provide this and no one else does. Like no one else gives us this thing. We need to get it from you. You're our only option. That's an amazing feeling because you're adding this value that didn't exist. You're almost creating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in some ways, you're creating something that no one else does. That idea initially sounds super grand, like, oh, before Google, like Google was the first person to invent like search or whatever, but it doesn't necessarily need to be that grand. It's like, you're the first person to offer this type of service in this type of way using this type of process. And you're alone in doing that.
You know, it's kind of crazy that like you can make such small changes, but have such a different business as a result, right? Like all we do is we buy properties for less than what they're worth in markets and make it accessible to investors, do all the kind of curation, and then we offer it to an investor in our network that is looking to break into these markets, but it's not accessible to them. They don't have the know-how, they don't know where to go, they don't know how to manage the process. What we've done differently is we've made it 100% virtual. So investing in real estate without ever seeing it at a very high yield, without us having to ever own the property, but buy and resell on the same day. It's these micro innovations on each side with this vision of like increasing the accessibility of like high quality, high yielding investments and allowing anyone to do it, that blows it open because it is still, like you said, like kind of an archaic space.
Oh yeah, definitely. And like from everything from researching markets to actually, you know, finding things off, you know, off market or under market value. And then the whole process after that is, yeah, it's a nightmare.
Yeah. And letting someone in like the Bay Area who's working like a, you know, a $250,000 a year tech job who wants to move that money, but doesn't have the time to kind of learn that space, to be able to create something where someone can own a large, highly tangible asset and make a purchase decision within like 5 minutes. That's the goal.
I love it. I think you're well on the way to that for sure. I mean, the type of information that you provide to your investors, I've seen it firsthand. It's like, yep, everything I could need to make this decision other than like the psychologist's couch of saying, don't have fear, go for it.
Well, and it's got to get better too, right? Like I think the internet like still needs to play a bigger role in the ownership of property. Cause I think the ownership of property is no longer like the investment that a lot of like the new generation of money prefers because it is not attached to like the way the new generation of money thinks, which is all tech, hands off. Like it's easy to go on a brokerage account and purchase shares, right? But like the concept of purchasing property, they don't like that process. That's not how the 30 to 40 year olds who are doing well in today's world and motivated professionals, that's not how they want to invest, right? So there's this, I think, a concept of like an online marketplace that is fully self-serve for a property owner who wants to sell and a buyer, but guided by the marketplace itself so that every bit of information you need drives a certain sale price suggestion like to a seller, and then the property's up with no obligation for anyone who wants to invest in that property to look at. And they don't have to call a realtor and ask questions. Everything they need is right there and the process is like self-facilitated. I think that's what like the democratization of real estate investing really looks like. And I think it's the future of it because the space is not going anywhere. Real estate investment and real property is something that is always going to be needed, period. We're not gonna like have you ever seen Westworld?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, we're not gonna like live in like the cloud, right? Like we're not gonna have like our consciousness extracted from us at least in the next like maybe 20 years, who knows how soon it'll come, right? But we're not gonna have our consciousness extracted from us and like stored in like a server farm somewhere and just like live in this virtual universe. We do need tangible places to stay and use to some extent. And I think the accessibility gap is like, the accessibility needed is up here and the current accessibility of real estate's down here and it's causing the space to become unsexy. And there's gonna have to be not just a gradual closing, but a leap to make this accessible again. And I think that leap is going to happen pretty soon. And it's going to involve the internet.
I love it. Well, let's wrap up with one last topic here. You've been talking a lot recently about this quote that Elon Musk said around, you know, can we achieve our 10-year goals in 6 months and how sort of powerfully disorienting that can be. Tell us about your thoughts around that and what our audience should take away from this idea.
You know, I think Elon's like such a dork. I'm not a giant fan of him, like personality wise, but he's a genius, right? And actually that quote inherently got me thinking about so much more. And like, you know, you and I are motivated individuals, right? And I assume a lot of the listeners on this podcast are highly motivated, ambitious individuals looking for ways to think differently. And I think we still limit ourselves greatly. And when I heard him say that, I went, why the hell do I even have a 10-year goal? Like, why does anyone have a 10-year goal? Like, life changes so fast when you actually get after it that like your 10-year goal is a moving target that could be in like a different universe in the first place. I think what 10-year goals do is they give us an excuse to do things slowly, right? Because the truth of it is, like if you look back on the last 10 years of your life, like you probably could have never predicted the things that you would have accomplished by now. Imagine if you had thought bigger and you expand or compress that down to 6 months. Compressing goals to a shorter term, that in itself forces you to actually get up and build something. Even if it's just a plan, it forces you to make a plan because when you're racing against the clock, and a lot of us like high functioning entrepreneurs have like basically like high functioning anxiety, right? It's what drives us through like our careers and our success. And one thing that's characteristic of us is procrastination. We're so busy doing this thing over here today that like the thing that we know is more important, we just wait till the last minute. and stretch goals just get pushed off. So 6 months or making a 6 month timeline for something, oh man, it makes you put all kinds of plans together and then attach like figures to it. Here's the resources I need. Here's what I'd have to do. And then it actually gets you thinking about, this is really important, I think, for the entrepreneur, stopping doing the things that you have to do now so that you can focus on this, which makes you go, how can I stop doing the things that I'm doing right now so that I can focus on this? And just out of thinking about that goal, we've got another hire here. I've delegated more duties to an investor relations rep. Like we've raised marketing budgets here so that marketing can replace like manual effort, or you can kind of supplant like conversion through effort with just stacking the lead pipeline bigger. But now the lead pipeline's bigger. So you're going, okay, how can I make the qualification process better and more automated? Like just so I can clear my table to chase the 10-year goal in 6 months, I've had to change my business, or at least my plans for my business. It's an amazing exercise that I think all of us should engage in.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, really any mental exercise that makes you look at the parameters that are defined and destroy them and say, do something different. Like we have this thing at our company that we call the 10-10 rule, that will look at different situations and we'll say, okay, well, if the, you know, the outcome of doing it the traditional way is like whatever X, we'll look at it and we'll say, how do we do that thing, but get 10 times the value for 1/10 the investment?
Which is,
and you look at that,
crazy thing.
And it's like, yeah, it's like impossible. But what it definitely does is it makes you say, well, we can't do it the traditional way. There's no way to do that, get that return on the traditional
That's it.
Way.
That's it. That's it. I think more people need to think like that. I mean, if you could let me tell a little story of how this whole thing started.
Yeah.
Accidentally. Like I was working in sales at this SaaS company. I was making good money. I was getting taken care of, dude. I was drinking cold pressed juices on their dime every day. Right. Like I don't think I drank like non-sparkling water in my life for like a year and a half. Like they catered to us and I was good at the job and it was easy. And I got my business partner and we're like, let's just start buying rental properties. And maybe if we like really push it, we could replace our incomes and quit our jobs in 5 years, which is often the goal of like even extremely successful individuals who invest in real estate. They go, I want to replace my income and quit my job. And we actually started chasing better deals. After our first deal, we said, let's go get even more discounted, better properties. Let's start marketing directly to these property owners and just trying to hunt for stuff at crazy low prices and keep them for ourselves as rentals with better returns, right? That's the goal, is get more cash flow and quit a little bit sooner than 5 years. Well, this is what happened. We bought 3 properties in a month, all cash that came in because they were all good deals, way sooner than we thought. And then we emptied our cash reserve. We spent all our money on these properties. And here's what happened the next month. 3 more really good deals came in and we didn't have money to buy them. And we're like, man, we need the money to buy this. How do we do it? Let's sell those 3 from last month. Then we sold those 3 from last month and we made like 30 grand real quick on properties that we didn't even like do anything to. And then those next 3, we're like, ooh, should we keep these or should we sell them to buy the next 6 or 7, right? And we sold them. And guess what? The whole quitting the job thing in 5 years, that happened 4 months after our first deal was done.
Wow.
4 months after. And it required us to, and it's not a brag, but it required us to break our business model that we had kind of preconceived. It completely break it, just throw it in the trash. And as soon as we threw that model in the trash, by force feeding ourselves opportunities and reasons to break the model, then all of a sudden like 10X happened.
Wow. That's so powerful, man. I mean, what a great way to wrap up this episode on that incredibly powerful story about how to shake up ideas. So, I mean, Elliot, you've been amazing. Thank you so much for carving out some time here. Is there any parting words you want to share with our audience as we wrap up?
Oh man, I mean, I've said so many words thus far. I think for people to like just not conform to like whatever ideas exist is so important. I think kind of running into that brick wall and like if everyone doesn't think you're wrong and kind of crazy and like is a little annoyed by you, then you're probably like not tapping into like your latent ability, right? So like just go out there and like do something that you like everyone thinks you should.
My God,
that's
not
like not self-destructive, right? Like don't go on a bend or anything like that. But
don't go kill somebody. But
yeah, if your mom and dad don't think it's a bad idea at first, it's actually a bad idea.
I love talk about not conforming. I love it. That's such a good note to end on. Well, Elliot, you're the man. Thank you so much. Can't wait to chat with you again, my friend. And for everybody else listening, if you want to learn more about the podcast or request to appear as a guest yourself, check us out at tedharrington.com/podcast, and we'll catch you next time.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Tech Done Different Podcast with Ted Harrington. If you learned something new and this conversation made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.